Welcome to Travel People, living authentic lives, finding kindred spirits, and fulfilling dreams. Here we talk about essential journeys, what I call beauty breaks for the soul. They lead us home to the people we were created to be. My guests are masters of reinvention and growth, and they live around the globe. They're going to share their travel go-to places and give insider tips on where and how to take time outs in their backyards. They'll inspire and empower you to plan your next adventure, to live your best life of relationship, rejuvenation, rest, whatever it is that you need and seek. I'm Cindy McCain, travel writer and blogger at Southern Girl Gone Global, where I share my journey as a mom, explorer of 27 countries, former expat, and empty nest survivor. When my children flew away, I did too, for a while. I landed in Morocco. After 2 years there and one in the Caribbean, I'm back in Nashville teaching university English, telling travel tales, and coaching others as they write theirs. I'm so excited to introduce you to some of the colorful cohorts that I've met from around the world, whose heads and hearts push me to press on in growth, live by core values, never settle, accept change. They make me laugh, and no matter how far or long we're apart, they remain my ride or die friends. We'll start with where they are, where they've been, and how they got there. I'll never forget teaching high school students in Marrakesh. We study many works that are in our Western curriculum, but I particularly love teaching them The Odyssey and The Alchemist because I felt like I was living a journey at that time too. The mission of every episode that you will hear is that we remember the truths Alfred Lord Tennyson expressed in his poem, Ulysses. I am a part of all I have met. Come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a better world. For those of us healthy and at home, we're finding that being grounding can be grounding. We're more in need of connection than ever. Some of us are thinking about where we want to go from here. So maybe this is just the right time that we come together. Okay, welcome everybody. Today's guest is my dear friend, Dr. Kim Roberts, and she is speaking to us today from Jacksonville, Oregon. So, hi Kim, so glad you're here.
Good morning, afternoon, whatever it is.
it's kind of both, morning for you, afternoon for me. And so, I'm thrilled to have her. Kim, just kind of tell them a little bit about what you do out there and then kind of describe what is your setting right now while we're talking in your new home.
Got it. Okay. So I am in Jacksonville, Oregon, which is a giant city of 3,000 people. It's actually 2,800 something, but I noticed they didn't change the sign when Andy and I moved here. There's probably more. So a lot of people, it's a very small town in very southern Oregon. It's beautiful. We bought a historic home. It was built in 1865. And it's great, except for everything is tiny. So the kitchen's tiny. We can't make any changes to the outside of the home. So even if we want a bigger kitchen, we can't push out. So if you want to get a glass of water from our refrigerator and you want to go to the pantry, you have to wait till the person is finished. It just can't be done. So small house, it was a farm. And then the townhomes surrounding us that was the actual farmland. But it's a lovely place. It's called the Keegan House. There are two Keegan houses in Jacksonville. So they were brothers, apparently. So we're the second Keegan House. We're across from a historic school campus, which is lovely, and you can see from our front the patio, which has twinkly lights, and you know how I feel about twinkly lights.
Yes.
So they make me happy. Yes. And it's a German restaurant and a beer garden, so they have movies there all the time, so when life is normal, of course. So you can hear movies and kids laughing, and it's a lovely place. Very small town. People walk back and forth all the time, so when I'm working, I see them walking past and sometimes they wave, and it's really sweet. It's a sweet town. We've been here about a year and a half moved here from Nashville.
Yeah. Beautiful. I went to visit last summer and, I mean, deer, you know, families, come up and down, the street, just like neighbors do. So it really is something almost like we said, out of a Disney set or something. It's really neat.
Yeah, you do feel like you're in a movie setting, and people are nice here, and I'm convinced just because they're happy to be here.
Yeah.
So my husband was worried, there's that, you hear that term in the Pacific Northwest. People talk about the Seattle freeze. It's difficult to make friends. Of course, this isn't Seattle's Oregon, but it is the Northwest. And he said, just know it's not like the South. They're not going to be like Southerners. So when you're all, wah, they're just going to think you're wacky. That may still, and I just am not aware of it, but they're still very friendly. It's been a very warm reception and a lovely, move. We've been very happy here. And as part of why we moved here was we like to mountain bike, old people mountain biking. We don't want to do technical over roots and rocks and scary things because I have broken my neck before. Don't care to do that again. And we like to hike, and there's so many things to do. Our to-do list in Oregon is it will take us years. So it's a good move for us. The lifestyle is very active, and we just love it. And the weather's great, and I have better hair here, so it's all good.
So one thing I want to ask before we get into more about the move and why you moved from Nashville and where you lived before that, and is I'm kind of starting all of these with sort of a COVID check-in, like how are people coping? What's happening there regarding the pandemic?
It's different. Our governor has been pretty conservative, even though we're convinced, many of us, that part of the reason our numbers are lower is because Oregon's just not as densely populated as many other states. But there are few cases in this particular county. So Jacksonville's in Jackson County. So there aren't very many here, but there are certainly some in Multnomah near Portland. And people, it's funny, now there's takeout, there's a few restaurants that are open at half capacity. But people are being very conservative about going out as a rule. And you'll see, we went to a winery last night. I don't know if you went to that one. It's called Hummingbird Estates. It was new, I think, and it's lovely. And they have a big, they have a lot of land, and then they have a big terrace. So the tables were far more than 6 feet apart. They were wearing masks, the folks pouring the wine. So it was very easily and beautifully done as far as feeling safe. The grocery stores, of course, a lot of them have the, one way, this way, so you can get it right. And of course, invariably, I'm walking backward down the wrong one. But
Me too.
and so generally, people wear masks, not always, but generally, so that's it. And I think the last report we heard was that mid-June, roughly the 17th, I don't know why that arbitrary number, but they will open the restaurants to full service. But I have been surprised that even the ones that are open, people have been slow to return to them in full.
Here
But
too.
yeah, that's been I've been surprised by that, and actually glad. I mean, I think it's something we should be cautious about. So no one wants to be foolhardy. And our local bookstore, Rebel Heart Books, fabulous independent bookstore. Yeah. So Eileen was an ER doc, is also married to a physician, and she wanted to wait till after the holiday to open because she was afraid it would be just too chaotic downtown. We have a, little teeny downtown that you loved. And
Yes, I do.
so yes. So people are being conservative and safe, in my opinion. That's what I see anyway every day. Luckily here too, because there's so many trails and places to walk, I haven't felt as stifled and panicked. I need to move, as you know. So I've been able to hike and do the trails, and you can do that safely here. So it's been, if you have to be quarantined, this has been a nice place to be.
Absolutely. I mean, I think being outside, and we're so fortunate, when we when I interviewed our friend Monty in Spain, I mean, they were locked down in an apartment where she had no balcony, no outdoor space, and that would be really hard to take. I've survived by being on my tiny patio and having being able to walk around because where I live in Nashville, there's a lot of, we have parks and we have, well, even just the complex I live in, I can walk the dog and not be near anybody because it's surrounded by greenery. So I think that's been very therapeutic for sure. And What are other things that you would recommend that for people? Because even though things are opening up here, I think there's still a lot of fear. There's a lot of anxiety. What are ways that people can cope with this thing as it lingers on?
Sure. And it will for a while.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about that. And I've thought about it a lot and I've read a lot of articles about mostly anxiety. You know, the anxiety that we have is generally around uncertainty. So if you think about the things you panic about and you mull over and over in your, that dark hour between what, 3 and 4 in the morning.
Yep.
Yeah. Those are what I think of
every
second in my life.
Yeah.
And then also usually related to animal care, you know, should have done that. But it's, shouldn't have said that. But those things and things that are just utterly out of your control. So for humans, you know, we're built to look for danger. And so we are designed to assess danger, but where is the danger now? You know, we're not being chased by dinosaurs anymore. So where does that fight, flight, freeze thing go?
Yeah.
You know, so when you are in something like a pandemic where we don't fully understand it, there's so much misinformation out there that confuses and terrifies people. And so I think the best way to cope with this is knowing that you can't control it. So what can you control? You know, you can control your health, your staying connected like we've done. We've had Zoom calls and, you know, it's been really fun to catch up. And honestly, in some ways, I have heard people say they have reconnected with friends really that they haven't talked to in years because of it, because it's forced a slowing down.
Right.
So, you know, there's some good to it. I'm not going to say there's good to 100,000 people dying. That's horrible. I also think there are you know, their deaths that aren't recorded because people didn't get the care they needed or they just didn't go. Wow. So surgeries were postponed, you know, treatment was postponed because they're afraid to go to the hospital or they're at capacity. I know here, I talked to a nurse last night at the winery who said that she was laid off because there were no surgeries happening. So everything had just shut down. So there's a lot of bad. Certainly just focusing on what you can do to stay healthy, stay connected, stay mindful. I work on a crisis line. I just changed to that position in my company, which I don't think I can say the name of it, but it's a lot of the calls we're getting are, worry about money, worry about return to work. Some are large companies that are reopening. So people are nervous about that. How can we safely do that? And honestly, you don't know the answer. You just don't know the answer to that. Just taking every step you can to be safe. And then hopefully, you know, we can get this under control in the next year. But people are adaptable. You know, we've gone through so many things and you have that initial anxiety. We can't maintain that extreme level of anxiety forever.
Right.
So there's a point at which you go, all right, I'm settling into this thing, which is what we have now. So then what do I do with it? And how do I stay safe? We've gone mountain biking out by Lake of the Woods, which is just gorgeous. And, you know, people are getting out and doing things. And I'm seeing that. I read last night on a blog. And they were saying that their husband made a bingo board of things people are doing to stay healthy. So every morning they get up and somebody will have, you know, went for a hike, went for a dog walk.
Oh, cool.
So there's good that's come out of it. I see people doing home projects and we do really fast. Our culture is so fast and I'm certainly a part of that. I'm a worker, so I tend to work myself to death and I feel like I have to do that. It's something I struggle with all the time. So it's definitely slowed people down, even though my husband and I have been lucky enough to be able to work. Our work hasn't been interrupted, so we're grateful for that. But it has definitely still caused some slowing down. So,
yeah. Well, and that, you know, I know too that you have been taking online classes and I think a lot of people are doing that, trying to learn. You might tell them, you know, at what stage of your life you actually got your PhD.
I went back at, was it 50? Yeah, I guess let's see, I'm 56. I got it. Yes, 50. So I went back at 50 because when I finished my master's in 89, when dinosaurs were on the earth, but finished then. And then I worked 3 jobs to go through school. So I could not bear even another day of having to do that. I was exhausted.
Yeah.
So I finished work and went into the very lucrative counseling field, as you know, it's very So,
like teaching.
Yeah, counseling and teaching. We're in the money. So, but it's meaningful. This is important.
Yes, it is.
So I did that, and then I couldn't go back. I wanted a doctorate, and one of my professors at that time said, "You will so regret not continuing this. And 3 more years of your life, you could do it." Honestly, I couldn't conceive of it. So I stopped at my master's, got my license, and then worked in counseling. And I worked in therapeutic foster care. I did lots of nonprofit stuff. Again, big money. And but loved it. Very fun. I did EAP, private practice. Just loved it. And then got married, moved to New Orleans, and then worked there. So it took me a long time to get to the point where I had the time to slow down and not have more than 2 jobs that I could dedicate to school, which I grossly underestimated the hideousness of a doctoral program. It's really awful.
Yeah.
And so it took over my life, and you were a part of that because I had to say no to everything. Just because people would say, "Kim, do you want to?" I'm like, "Mm-mm. Can't really do anything fun." And I would just gaze out the window at people walking by. Having a life. But the bad side of it was, I feel like I lost 4.5 years. The good side is it forever changed the way I think and the way I see things. Mm-hmm. I loved, surprisingly, because I'm such an extrovert, I loved the research piece of it. And I'm sad that I don't have access to the academic library, which, by the way, some of those grants are, government funded, and it's unfair. So there's my little hit against us not having access to academic journals. But I love that piece of it. I loved studying more about psychology because I've always, I've done it. My undergrad was in psychology and Spanish. My master's was in counseling psych, and then my PsyD. So I've loved this field. I've been in it forever. I've never, ever gotten tired of it. So I finally finished last February. I defended while they were weed eating the hillside across from me. So it was very stressful. The whole process was painful, but I really do. I know it's cliche to say you grow from it, but I certainly did. Think differently. I feel differently about it. It's an awesome experience, other than not having a life for almost 5 years. Yeah. But it's been great. So glad to be done.
Well, we've stayed in touch through so many years, because while you were doing that, 3 of those years I was living abroad, and so we were doing, when we could, Skype calls, and then when I got home was about the time that you were finishing up, and I guess the program, and within like a year you moved to Oregon. So we've lived apart for a long time. So maybe let's go back and I want to talk about, let's start with what you majored in, Spanish as well. And so maybe tell them, since the big things we talk about on here, of course, are just growth, change, reinvention, and how travel has it impacts the way we see the world and ourselves. So kind of go back to where you studied when you were, and was that the first time you had been abroad, was when you did? So kind of tell them that story.
Yeah. Okay. So I went to University of Georgia, super fun place. Woo-hoo. And I had dead broke. I mean, it was just dead broke, but somehow managed to figure out how to get, because when I tested, I had a great teacher in high school. So shout out to the high school teachers of the world. She was amazing. And so when I took 2 years in high school and exempted past a minor when I tested out at Georgia. So I thought, I'm past a minor, might as well keep going, Capricorn. And it was so hard. It was a much more difficult major than my psych major, except for the stats and the research piece. But so very difficult, but loved the language, found it almost easy. I'm not going to say easy because I'm very humbled by my inability to come up with a coherent sentence when I'm around someone who's fluent. But I thought, I love this so very much. And so we studied culture. Then I got to college, decided, let's figure out if I can get to Spain. So some friends and I went, had a blast. We spent a week, and I was thinking about this yesterday, spent a week in Madrid living in a dorm. And so, of course, all the Americans hung out. We spoke English. And so then when the buses came to get us to take us to live with our families, we were all, these 21-year-old, thinking we were so cool, sobbing, we're leaving our friends. And we were terrified.
Yeah.
Because hearing the language when no one else is speaking English was terrifying. So I couldn't understand anything. And then there was a a young girl living in the home too. And she took me to a party. And I just remember going, and for the first time in my life, being the silent wallflower. And the first words I understood. So I was trying not to panic. And they were asking all these questions. And I was just going, apparently I can't speak. And I heard one of them say, mira la luna que tenemos. Look at the moon we have. And I say that all the time because that was not only the first sentence I understood, but it was also a realization of how Spaniards, because those are the people I was with, really notice their surroundings.
Yes.
They notice
the
beauty around them. They all the time, que maravillosa, they're commenting on the mountains. They really love their surroundings and beauty and nature. And so that was an eye-opener for me. But I loved it. I was just there for a long summer and then traveled for a month, spending, $5 a day if I could, and staying in terrifying places. But it was a great experience, and it totally changed my life. And we've talked about this. I was in Paris. We met these young guys. And, of course, the friend I was with looked like a supermodel, so we got everything free. And, I would just I would go in and ask for a room, and they'd be like, sorry. And then my friend would go, and she would go, I got the suite at the top of the, so I just had to push her up front. But we met these young guys, and they were walking us around Paris, and I was thinking, it occurred to me, the time difference, and it occurred to me at that moment, all this is going on when I'm in Georgia, all this is still happening.
Yeah.
So realization that you are just the tiniest of specks, and that your world is even tinier than that. It's just astounding.
Yeah.
So... yeah, exposure to the culture, the people who were there, absolutely changed my life. No going back. I came back from Spain a different human being. So, undoubtedly.
Yeah, Paris was the city that I had that same realization. I think it was the first time that I'd gone to Europe, and I remember I was married then, and I called back and said, I was speechless, and I just said, the world is just so big, it's just so, we drove in at night, and it's the city of lights, and, but it, for some people, I think they view travel as a one-time event, but for me, it became just, I don't want to say, kind of an addiction, where but I had the advantage of the only way I could afford it was the fact that I took student groups there. And traveled for, all my travels to Europe were with students until I met up with you in Barcelona after one of those trips. And that was actually, I think, the first trip that I had done. I'd done some trips. I had done some other trips with, organizations where I went and met people in Ireland and in Italy. But that one was, just a fun trip to meet up, and we had a great time. And you used to go to Spain a lot, just almost every summer. So,
A friend of mine had her husband's family had an apartment in Estepona, so it's near Marbella.
Yeah.
So we would go every summer, and we would get every other trip was paid for with our flight miles, and then we were in the apartment, and so we were able to do that in a way that didn't cost so much, and we loved it and had a blast and had some adventures and. Just really fun. Met some great people.
Yeah.
The piano bar there that we love. And so we had our buddies singing around the piano every night. Just
so
beautiful.
Great.
And traveled around to see different places. But you have a real soft spot for Spain.
Yeah.
Love that country. Yeah.
We actually, then we met in a Italian class because I kind of had the thing for Italy while you had the thing for Spain. But you were taking Italian, and what do you remember about that? Because that was funny. I remember a lot about that.
I remember thinking, that girl's cute. I like her. And then, but I also remember, and I know that you're going to say this, because again, why am I wearing a tank? I'm always hot, and I hate to be hot more than anything. This is when I lose my sense of humor, and every picture of me, in a hot location, I have this scowl and a beverage. But I was so hot, and the room was small, and I felt claustrophobic. And the image I have is me coming in like a hurricane with no thought to anyone else and just opening the window. I was burning up.
Yeah, she did. She sashayed in. She had on this fun skirt. And I remember her saying she'd been out dancing all night the night before. And And she was like, oh, it's so hot. And she flung the window open. And yeah, and I was freezing. But it was funny because I think there were two other people in the class, and they were very shy. And I was terrible. I'm terrible at language. And the teacher kept giving this sentence for the one guy to read. Or maybe you did. I don't know. But it was all about this shy guy in the class. He had to keep talking about how he had gone out dancing. And you could tell he probably had never been dancing in his life. But that was fun. And we just, after that, became partners in crime. And we then really joined kind of this salsa community, Latin dance community, which was because you had gone to a Spanish speaking meetup and met a couple of the guys that were the leaders of this group. And from there, I mean, we spent the next several years, multiple times a week, not just once a week, sometimes two and three times a week, doing salsa events. And yes. Yeah, which was super fun.
It was so fun. And remember when we had that, and that music, I mean, who cannot love
it's
salsa?
It's great, yeah.
It's brilliant. Mm-hmm. If you don't move to salsa, I'm worried about you a little. And maybe an assessment. But remember we had that party at my house in East Nashville, yeah. And we looked around and there were 11 countries represented.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. People from all over the world we met. And so Kim was in East Nashville, which is at that time, one of the main places at that time was our friends, Pablo and Jonathan, had like an every weekend or every other weekend at Madonna's, which was a really fun place there in East Nashville. And so Kim lived in the neighborhood. So we would often meet at her house and then we would, you know, kind of have a couple of drinks and then we'd head over and we did birthday parties. We did, those people really became like our social group and we did all kinds of things, you know, from, you know, vacations to, we met people that just became, you know, we go out to eat, movies, weddings. I mean, it really grew into a pretty, pretty tight group of people. And we met so many interesting people. A lot of people came and went through the years, but really, really fun. So.
Yes, it very much became that. It was our family. So it really, I mean, still, it's not that they're not people that we love and care for. We just aren't, our lives have gone in different directions.
Yeah.
It was amazing. I mean, I think of that, you know, we've talked about before that whole sliding doors concept where you take this turn in your life. It's very different from had you taken that, you know, it's an interesting concept. But for us, all the things that had to come together for us to meet and then find that group of people that was interesting and vibrant and you know it makes you feel really alive to be around that music and those people and it was great.
I think we were really committed to we wanted to live a joyful life and which began as taking we took lessons at the Global Education Center, which is an amazing place in Nashville, for about 10 months every Sunday night. And then at that time there were a couple of different restaurants in town that live bands would play and everybody would go out. And, you know, it was a great way to kind of start the week. And, so there were the Friday and Saturday night events, but then there were those just Mexican restaurants, people just get up and dance around the tables. And it was super fun, very joyful. So I guess then in 2014 was when I moved to Morocco for 2 years and then the Dominican Republic. But before that, we'll stay on this track for a minute. So you got married and you moved to Franklin, Tennessee, which is very different than East Nashville.
Very different.
That was another change. And so I want to go back because you talked about New Orleans. So in New Orleans, and I got to see this because we went to New Orleans together. You had sort of a reunion with your band. Kim was actually she was the band leader of a band that, you know, won awards and was really cool. So tell them a little bit about your life in New Orleans before you even came to Nashville.
Yeah. And I feel like I was just a singer. My musicians are amazing. So I marvel when I listen back to somebody sent me some songs recently, and I thought, wow, they're just awesome. And I knew it then, but to hear it again, just great musicians. So I was married to a musician at the time, and I appreciate this about him. He encouraged me to sing because I love to sing. My whole family can sing. I sort of thought it was normal that people can sing, but I was terrified. So the first show I did, my voice sounded like this and I was shaking. So terrified, but much happier with a band than just playing on my own. So we ended up starting this band called the Swingin' Haymakers. And the only reason we won awards is because there were no other country bands. So it would be like best country band in New Orleans. There's only one, but we won. So we had fun and great time. Even when my husband at the time was traveling, because he played, you know, 250 plus days a year, I would play with the guys, and I made just enough money to pay my horse's board. I had a horse and I just could afford to keep him because of my band money. Yeah. So, you know, yet another lucrative situation. But yeah, I loved it. It was really fun. I was too chicken to pursue it. I don't like the self-promotion that it involves, and I don't like that. So I didn't pursue it and was too chicken. I had that safety thing around money. So I didn't do that for a living, but loved doing it on the side and still love to. I'm still a just rotten guitar player, but I try, and I've been practicing during this pandemic quarantine situation. But great time. The musicians are awesome. Had a guitar player that plays still a B bender, which is just fabulous. I had at one time a steel player who was amazing. Drummer, awesome, Joey. My bass player you met and loved, Dave, who is just a New Orleans character. He's an institution. So just amazing. We had so much fun, and they were so good to me. And when if the club owner was being weird and wouldn't pay us, Dave would be like, "I'll go get it," and be back in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
We played every other Sunday at a club in the Warehouse District called the Howling Wolf. And so that was really fun because they did a barbecue that was free, but you're supposed to tip the band. So they had this trough in the front and people would tip the band. And it was a blast. It was like a giant party with all of your friends. And so it was just the neatest period. And New Orleans is amazing. It's, it's just hot. It's hot there.
Yeah.
But
tell just a little bit about the lifestyle there. I mean, the fun things, to do in New Orleans.
No city like New Orleans. So anybody and people who live there, one of my best friends was Mike, and so much love the city, and they have a real pride about New Orleans, and rightly so. There's all the history, the color. Ooh, we're getting lightning, so you probably see that coming through. Very unusual for Southern Oregon. But the color, the history, the music, just the pace of it, which having moved there from Atlanta, which is faster, even though it's Southern and people think we're all sort of slow Southerners, not so much. But I got to New Orleans and thought, nothing works. These people move slow. But then I got used to it. I loved it. And it was just a nice culture. I have friends that will be lifelong friends. And we had a whole group of us who were married to musicians. And so the band wives. And so we had our own little culture because our husbands were gone all the time. So we did our own thing, and it's just a neat place. Great food. Of course, I'm vegetarian, so not so easy for me, but great food, great culture. Yeah. I remember the first St. Patty's Day, when I was washing my car, which I never do. I don't know what I was doing. Washing my car, and these people were walking by with coolers, and I thought, what? And I finally just said, where are y'all going? And they said, are you kidding? The parade's coming down in a minute. Head down here with us. So I put everything up, ran down there. And so they throw vegetables from the floats, and you are supposed to make a stew out of it. So within, 30 minutes, I found myself. I had already gotten a cabbage. You have to catch it so it doesn't beam in your head. And I found myself screaming, throw me potato. It's just crazy. New Orleans, they celebrate everything.
Yeah.
So. Neat. I hate the downside, of course, was floods every, pretty frequently.
Yeah.
Super hot. I just don't do well in heat, as we've discussed, and we'll probably come up a couple more times. But yeah, but lovely place. It was a good time. I was ready for a change when I, suggested we move to Nashville. I felt like I wanted to be, I love, and I know Nashville isn't mountainous, but to me it was, being in New Orleans, which is below sea level. Here comes the dog because of the storm. So I wanted to be around more green land, all that. I wanted to buy a mini farm so I could keep my horse, at the house. So that's how we moved. And plus it's a music town, so we felt like maybe it'd be a good move for us. So, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. We when I went down that weekend, and I'll show a clip from, I think I've still got the clip from you on stage that weekend. But we went to the Rock and Bowl, and that was so much fun. Now I had seen a little bit of Zydeco because we went to some event here in Nashville. That,
yeah.
Where was that? I was trying to think. Do they still do that? Do you remember? It was like a crawfish bowl or a boil or a.
That was that Tom and let me think where that was. I don't remember where it was, but it was, yeah, our neighbors that are from Louisiana.
Yeah, yeah. So that was the first experience I had with Zydeco. But we went and there was that little Nate or little Nathan or somebody that was playing at the Rock and Bowl, and people of all ages were bowling, eating, and dancing, and of yeah. all ages, children oh. up to older people. So
how do you ask you to dance? There's none of yeah. that. You're good and you're not gonna make yeah. me look good, so I'm not gonna ask you to dance.
Yeah. No, it's fun. No,
yeah.
All about the fun. It was all about the fun. But yeah, so you moved here and bought the farm. And that was a kind of another life because the culture of just riding horses all the time. You were very much into that for many, many, many years.
Many years. Yeah. I got my first horse when I was 6. And so my dad is convinced that it kept me out of trouble because when you have a horse, it's a lot of responsibility.
Right.
I had them all right. through until I went to grad school and couldn't do it anymore. I could barely manage my own life, you know?
Right.
So I had
right.
them for years and then got back into them in Louisiana. And so I had boarded my horse on the North Shore and started riding dressage, which I really liked the structure of it, believe it or not, as wild as I seem, I like the structure of dressage because it's, you do this thing, you do it correctly and the horse is moving in the most proper balance. And then if you mess up this move, you got another one in about 4 seconds. So you can't dwell on your 20-meter circle that you messed up. You got to work on this thing. So it helped me in a mindful way move past mistakes in a very physical way, which is something I need. Like, I'm not a meditator. I'll do yoga, but I'm not going to sit down and just try not to think. Just doesn't work for me. But loved the horse world. Met great friends. We had a blast. Yeah. Went to shows every weekend and we'd giggle and stay up all night and be exhausted and then go to shows and, you know, all around Louisiana and some a little farther out and celebrate each other's victories. And, you know, somebody would invariably have a come apart because their horse would do something wacky. But super fun world. Then in Nashville, hooked up with a group of ladies who we mainly did trail riding. So we didn't show, had a blast. And it was our whole culture. We got up every weekend and met out there. And then we went to the Loveless and had brunch after. So just a fun word. Horses are the most amazing creatures. They really are. So I miss that. And I vowed to find a resource here to ride. So when I moved my horse home, I thought it would be a good thing. Unfortunately, what happened is I had an accident. I have border collies and they chase. And so I had this big, beautiful Hanoverian, gorgeous horse that was the fanciest thing I'd ever, you know, owned in my life. And so I just couldn't believe I owned him. And my border collie nipped at his heels and he bucked. I counted 6 before I went sailing and broke C6 and C7 and had to, at that time they were doing the collar for 6 months. And so then, that wasn't good. And then shortly after that, that horse was killed in a pasture accident and it was horrific. It was really traumatic. I felt very responsible for his death and I think he slipped in the mud or something. So I just thought, no, I don't ever want to have a horse at my house anymore. And I know that's an extreme reaction to an unfortunate event, but I really preferred being around other people, particularly when you hurt yourself and you're lying in a field
right.
wondering yeah. how you're going to get to a phone because there was no service in that front field.
Right.
So kind of a dark chapter there.
Yeah.
And then after that, divorced, which, you know, is not a lot of fun either. So not the best period of my life, but then what it forced, and if we're talking about how out of difficulty comes positive change, you know, I said, okay, I'm going to look at East Nashville as an option because this house is for sale. Let's see if I like it. And I remember my friend and I walked through the house and we were trying to act cool like we didn't like it. And then we went in the back and went, I love this house.
Yeah.
And everybody was cute and ended up instantly making friends and becoming part of that East Nashville feel and culture and just the interesting, you know, the art of it because it's an interesting place. And Kim and Cindy met them and they're still just great friends. And they really took me to places, introduced me to people. And So it became a great change that I really resisted. I hated losing that farm. It was the most painful experience of my life. The day I was told, not of my life, it's dramatic, but when I was told someone was buying it, yeah. I was devastated. I'd secretly hoped it would never sell. And so it turned out to be a very good thing. So that happens sometimes, you know, you don't get what you want and it's good. So,
well, yeah. That's, I think, a huge reason, you know, that I wanted you to meet people through this way and tell people, because I think sometimes when people hear you talk or me talk about travels to Europe, they think, you know, we're these rich girls, which I very much am not or have never been. I traveled because, like I said, I took students, you know, I chaperoned, I worked while I was there. Or, you know, I've just always had to find creative ways to do things like that. And so there's that. And I think too, you know, just adjusting to change and sometimes things don't go as we want them to in life. And sometimes change is forced upon us. And sometimes, you know, we welcome it and look for it. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why I've told you, I had this great professor in undergraduate, and it was some class that I did horribly in, like political science or something. And it was one of those huge stadium classes. And he was just cute. He was telling the story about when he got his PhD, he had to decide, do I stay here where my family's comfortable and in this job that's not prestigious, or do I take this fancy job in another state that holds prestige in the future for, you know, a more stable life. And he was pacing around. He'd worn a hole in the rug. And he called his mentor, who, of course, the picture he painted was that he was smoking a pipe and had, you know, tweed patches on his blazer. That's what we all pictured when he was telling the story. And he said he was talking to him, and he could hear his chair squeaking, so he knew he was listening. And he was telling, I don't know what to do. I can't make this decision. And he said there was about an 8-second pause, and he said, Ken, don't worry about making the right decision. Just worry about making the decision right. And he said he was furious. He was just furious.
Yeah.
He wanted help. But I've thought of that so many times. I mean, this was how many years ago? And that still sticks in my head. So it resonated, because things happen in life. And really, you can wallow a little bit. So you need to kind of kick around and feel sorry for yourself. That's all cool. But at some point, you have to go, this is the new reality. So what do I do with this? And how do I make this the best possible? So each day, what decision? You know, we say this all the time. I say this to you. I'll have an impulse to do something, gossip, something like, and I'll say, does that move me toward or away from the person I want to be? Now, I'm not always successful. Sometimes I move away from the person I want to be, but it is something that guides me. And it is something that I will say, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. Stay on your path, because that person is not who you want to be.
Yeah.
So I think that ties into change and how we adapt, even about this pandemic. How do we know how much is this world going to change? How does misinformation, you know, divide us politically? There's just so much happening, and you just have to make your world the best it can be and cope in the most healthy ways. So.
And I think so many people are going to face change, because some of it's going to be unwelcome, because so many, I think the statistic now is like 1 out of 4 Americans is out of work. So, so for some people, the jobs will come back, and for some, they're going to have to do something totally different. And then other people, or have used this time to figure out what they really want. And even though they would have never chosen to have this time to do that, but they've used it to kind of say, you know, life is short. I mean, what do I really want to do with my life? So, and you've always said that, you know, with changes, even good changes, you know, we lose something. I mean, we there's always a loss, because I was listening to something. It was saying even when you buy a great new house, there's still, you have feelings attached to the old house, or there's something that you feel a sense of loss for.
Yeah, for sure.
So,
that's moved here. We've talked about that. You know, I hated that house. We built that house.
Yeah.
And it was exactly to our specification, and it was very painful to leave it. But we had to say, this is the lifestyle we want. So the lifestyle is here. And we have to leave this house in order to get this lifestyle. And I remember sitting in the parking lot at Walgreens because I had to buy a lock to go on the trailer and just sobbing, you know, that we left that beautiful place. But it's a place, it's a house, you know.
Yeah, it was. I'll show pictures. And so we're going to take a break, but when we come back, yeah, I want to talk about, because I think a lot of people have thought about, you know, they'd like to make a major change. They'd like to make a move. So what is involved with that, and how do you know when it's time to move on, no matter what the pain's going to be of doing it, or the risk, or the whatever. So yeah. We'll come back and talk about that. Okay. So we are back. And, so what we're going to talk about on this show, I like to talk about, the journey, you know, sort of that Joseph Campbell talked about, that when we follow our bliss, there's usually just this universal pattern, and it typically starts with, we're in a place that's our home. It's familiar, but there's something that begins to call us elsewhere. And we often, there'll be drawbacks where we refuse the call and think, for whatever reason, that's crazy. I can't leave. I don't have the money. I don't have whatever. But then eventually there is something that pushes us over that threshold into a new world. And that's where the journey begins. And there are obstacles along the way. There are mentors. There are allies, there are risks we take, losses, but usually, hopefully, gains. So kind of tell us again, you guys had a beautiful home. We were just talking about you built a beautiful home. And you might mention, too, let's just even go back to this was a fresh start. You had just gotten married, and we're starting this new life together. And then how did you go from there in Franklin to where you are now?
Right. And yeah, so marriage, happy marriage, great union. And so this has been a good thing. The house was lovely. Andy designed it. You know, we had it built. The builder was amazing. So we loved it. And it looked over common area. So there was woods, which, of course, I love. I love green and forest. As, yep. You know, not a beach person. I want green. Yep. And so loved it. So we had been taking trips. So we would do, when we could afford it, it just depended on how things went. We would do a short trip, and mostly through airline miles, as you gathered, which hopefully won't go away. We'll see what happens with it.
Yeah.
But we would do airline miles, we'd travel, and we would do a Europe trip every other year or so if we could afford it. And then we would do a wine trip. So I love wine. I like learning about it. I like the art of it, the chemistry of it, just love it. Mm-hmm. So we would go to all these places, and we'd say, okay, we like Zinfandels, let's go to Lodi. We like cabs, let's go to Napa. So then we would go to Central Coast. We would try all these different places in California. And so once we hit the places in California that we wanted to go, and of course there's always more, but we said, let's start going to Oregon, and let's not do the traditional Willamette Valley. We're going to go Southern Oregon, which is entirely different. You know, it was the first AVA, the, you know, viticulture area in Oregon, but a very different one. Mm-hmm. So we said, let's just go to Southern Oregon. Andy had gone to Oregon State briefly for undergraduate. And then his mother was from this area originally, although she'd lived in Tennessee many, many years. Mm-hmm. But so had some connections here and some family here. So it felt a little familiar to him. His father was from Seattle. So it felt familiar to me. It was utterly foreign. And so we came out. And I instantly, you know how you love the beach. And so when you see the beach, mm-hmm. your body calms.
Yep.
And see,
so
I go, is there's sharks in there? Other things that take you down. I'm just not a fan. And it's hot. Yeah. So, yeah. But that's your comfort, and your body immediately calms down. And that's me with land. So when I see landscapes, mountains, when I can move, my relaxation needs to involve movement as a rule. So hiking, mountain biking, it's amazing. So we would combine our wine trips. We'd go, here's the wineries we want to hit. And so then we would, you know, perhaps to, you know, not feel guilty, we would go on a hike and then go to wineries. And we thought, this is a perfect life. So we started seeing people who were at the wineries for the wine pickups, and the wine, you know, the wineries have parties for their members. And so we thought, oh, this is kind of neat. So each winery area has its own culture mm-hmm. and world. And so there's music, there's events. And, you know, we went to a salsa band at one of the wineries. So fun.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we just started looking, and we looked in SLO, and we looked at all these places, and it just wasn't hitting right. And then we came out here and loved it. So this tiny town. And the next, you know, the next town over is Medford. The next town over is Ashland. And we went round and round. Do we move to Ashland? Do we move to Jacksonville? And we were kind of kicking it around, but it was terrifying to think about because it meant uprooting, leaving friends. And then, of course, I had been working on my doctorate, so I'd been kind of isolated anyway. You had gone on your journeys, and so you'd been gone. So I guess we were sort of used to and knew that we would stay in touch. Mm-hmm. So that made it a little easier. But I was also in the middle of the dissertation, so I wasn't keen to bring any more stress into my life. But I can't remember what drove it. Oh, we found this house, and it provided an opportunity to build an apartment where both Andy and my mom could move into. So we felt like it was the best opportunity, and it would be difficult to find that if we didn't jump on it. So that rushed our decision. Literally in the middle of chapter 4 of my dissertation. It was extraordinarily terrible timing. So we came out. No, I think we bought the house. We saw it, you know, we shopped, and then later we bought it. And we were trying to remember how big is the living room, you know, so it was just a crazy thing to do. And it was almost like, and I know you've experienced this because you had this same pull when you were leaving to go to Morocco. You have to just get the ball rolling first. And there's all these theories in psychology about motivation. And some people say, you know, you have to wait for the motivation to act. And I think with something this scary, you have to get it rolling first, and then the motivation will follow. Otherwise, you'll never do it. There'll be a million reasons why it won't work. Yeah. And it's impossible, and it's expensive. And it's, so we just did it, and we're terrified. And, you know, hated to lose the house. And for Andy, Franklin was very familiar. Not as much for me, but it was very familiar to him and friends there and all that. I already worked from home. I was used to that. I didn't feel so strange to leave. I was able to keep my job, and we piled all the dogs and the cat in the car. And it took us, we took 5 days. We took our time because of all the animals. So, and it was weirdly fun at that point. So once we got in the car and, you know, I'd be driving along and there's the salt flats and there's just amazing things that we saw on the journey out here. So anyway, it was a great move, highly suggested, but also know that you will border on nervous breakdown thinking you made a mistake. And I know that you did that. Yeah. But there's no, it's never going to be smooth and easy as a rule. It's going to be fraught with anxiety and fear. And it's just, you have to do it anyway. You know, you have to just do it anyway. Just push past it and go. For us, it's been a great thing. Now, had it not been, we would reassess and figure out what the next step would be. But fortunately, it's been really good for us to be out here. But scary. Yeah,
for me, you know, my son had been gone for 2 years, and I was just, had been at the same school from the time both kids were in kindergarten, and it was just, I was ready for a change. And I'd always wanted to live abroad for a year, but it took a while to make that happen. But once I decided, I was just going to check with Search Associates and go to one of their job things. And I really thought, I'm just going to go learn about it. And then in 2 years, when my son graduates from college, then I'll go. But the momentum started, and it, you know, every day I was, you know, writing letters to countries all over the world thinking, wow, I wonder where I'll end up. And so, yeah, and it just kind of takes on a life of its own, and you have things to do. You've got to downsize. You've got to sell things. You've got to, it's not easy to make a major move like that at all. But I know you're happy. I know you guys did downsize a lot. And like you said, you give up some of the things that you loved to have a life that you love even more. And so tell them about just some of the specific wineries, some of the favorite things that you've done so far.
I love it. Oregon's a great place. It's very underrated. And you loved it.
I did love it. Yeah,
it's really special. The Willamette Valley wineries, they of course, you know, they're famous for their Pinot Noir, which they're beautiful and refined. And then Oregon, Southern Oregon, the Pinots are going to be a little different because we're a warmer climate. We do have wide diurnal swings, so we can be 35 degree different from midday to evening, which, of course, you know I love, because if it's going to be really hot during the day, give me some cool.
Yeah.
And so because of that, we have so many varietals that we can grow here in Southern Oregon. So we can grow just about anything. It's really astounding. And so some of the wineries, as I've been here, so we've been here a little over a year and a half, we've started to pare down the wineries we're most drawn to. And they're typically, they're all small production, but they're farmers, which you forget about wineries. You think of it as being this fancy thing and you don't see what's behind it. They're farmers. So the fascinating thing about the ones we love the most are like this. So I brought some bottles up to show. Yeah. So this is Horn. Can you see it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So Horn, I don't think you went here, so we'll have to go out. Beautiful, beautiful place. And he is a biodynamic farmer. Mm-hmm. He and his wife. So they don't use, you know, they do the old fashioned. If you've seen the biodynamic process where they fill the cow horns with manure and bury the cow horns, and then they use that to make a soup sort of and put it over the vines. And people do it different ways. But typically the idea is that the least harm to the environment in their farm. So they have plantings like lavender to bring bees in. So, and they were going to harvest lavender and they couldn't bring themselves to do it because the bees. So they're those kind of people, which are my kind of people. There's always a winery dog. Just a neat culture. The wines are fabulous. There's all different kinds. They're, one of their whites is super popular. People love it. And we can link it and link their wines.
Yeah.
I tend to drink more reds. Now, this summer, we've had a couple, I mean, this spring, we've had a couple of warm days, and I've actually had some whites to the shock of
That's
all around me.
Unusual, yeah.
But they make beautiful, beautiful, rich, lovely wines and just so many varietals. We're not one thing. And part of the difficulty of I think, pushing this region, this wine region, is that we're not one thing. We grow all kinds of wines. So we're not a Pinot location. We're not a Syrah location.
Right.
You walk down the middle of a vineyard and have completely different, you know, soil and sun and wines to grow. So beautiful. And then another one I love, I think you did go here, to Simple Machine.
Yes, yes.
And they're just neat people too. Just really neat people.
Delicious.
And yeah. And they, what I like about them, the thing about both of these wineries, and there's so many others, these are just two that I grab because I have a special thing. So Brian at Simple Machine does whole cluster. He doesn't take the grapes off of the, you know, the cluster. He uses the whole cluster, has to hand pick out all the weirdness that goes into winemaking. He stomps the grapes himself. It's extraordinary. And they're very picky about what they produce, and they would rather do that than be fancy and have it, you know, just out of their control. So they're people who really care about the art of winemaking and the farming process, or even if, you know, the grapes are sourced elsewhere, just how they're treated and what comes out in the bottle. So you fell in love with the 2014,
yes,
Brunel,
that was
which
so
is
good.
So and this is the thing, it goes away.
So good.
But the 2016, I need to send you some. So this is, and it's really good too. This one is a blend. It's called Deuce. It's named after a dog they had. It's a cat. Yeah, they name a lot of them after their winery dogs. But neat people, neat culture. It's just a really underrated area. Yeah, so you can go, if you're thinking, I'm going to go visit some wineries, but I want to do other activities. You can paddleboard, kayak, you can do anything around here because there's lots of bodies of water and the mountains, and it's just amazing. It's a great place to visit and do things. So, very fun.
The wineries were so different. You know, there was the one that I felt like we were in Spain or Italy, sitting up on the big mountain, you know, looking at all of this. There was the one with the salsa that had the lakes and the swans, and there was the one that was by the river, and we saw people going by, and just so many different. And then the trails, you know, we took the dogs on the trails constantly. Just talk about some of those just in Jacksonville.
Oh yeah, you can walk, you know, I can walk a quarter of a mile, and there's a 2 mile, pretty short trail. And then there's the Brit, I call them the Brit trails. They're really the woodland trails. But, you know, the Brit, our big music festival every summer, which of course is off this year.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It is lovely. And you hear music all summer long and amazing concerts. And it's an amphitheater. But around that area are miles and miles of trails. So we could drive 5 minutes and have four or five different hikes, or we can just walk. And so a lot of times we just walk. And we were in a habit for a while of doing this one particular trail that has called Panorama Point. So you see the whole little city, And then we would walk down and go have Mexican food and put the calories immediately back on. But of course, now we can't do that yet, but we will be able to soon. So
yeah. The arts are big. I mean, there's the Brit Music Festival, and then there was also the Shakespeare Festival that's not far from you.
In Ashland, absolutely.
Yeah.
Huge festival, huge place.
And then when we were there, we went up to Crater Lake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is beautiful.
Astounding. You could go 100 times and your jaw will drop every time you see it. It's just extraordinary.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing. And we went to Lavender Fields. We went to the coast as well.
And good for you for saying coast. No one here says beach. It's always coast. No, you're an outsider if you say you're going to the beach.
Yeah.
Because this accent, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, but it's beautiful. I got to go to one of the book club meetings and meet some of the local people. I love the restaurant that has the giant tree that we would eat under. What's that? I forgot the name of that.
Union.
Yeah.
Such a great place. Such a great place. Local. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
So even though your trip this year to Spain and Portugal got canceled, as mine did to Italy, but you're going to, I'm sure, do road trips, and you do those all the time, hikes and bikes, riding. And
we do. And we had hoped to go when we had to cancel Portugal, and we waited and waited and waited and decided at this point it's not even responsible to think about going. So we canceled. And then we thought about going to Bend, because I haven't been there yet.
Yeah.
22 hours. And so we're going to spend the weekend in Bend and trails, all that. And we couldn't go there either. So what we've done so far, the trips are close enough that we can just drive there and do whatever activity, bikes or whatever, and then just head back home. And the coast had said, the folks in the coast had just said, don't go to the grocery stores and use our resources. And so we wanted to be respectful of that. So we did drive to the coast one day and back just in the same day. So we didn't want to, tax their resources. So
Yeah.
But you just make it work. We'll see what next year brings.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so I always end this with what you would tell a 30-something-year-old daughter or your 20-something-year-old daughter, 20-something-year-old self. But I also want to add another piece for you, because you did tell them a little bit about the doctoral work that you did. And for women that are single, over 50, what were some findings that maybe will encourage us or?
I loved that project, and I met some amazing women, and I really appreciate their contribution to it, because that makes everything. I studied repartnering when you're 50 and older, and specifically women who had divorced, because what I wanted to look at is when you divorce, do you then choose your next partner in direct opposition to your previous partner? Is that a conscious choice, or is it just that in the time that you met and married that first partner, you've made so many changes that you've moved on to a different set of values and what you want out of life. And, that person might have been fun when you were 20, but when you're 50, not so much. Mm-hmm. So I looked at all that and then what people were finding in the dating world and how it was affecting their lives. Because my thought is this: women still make less, we're paid less for the same job, just perpetually infuriating, but it's the truth. So there are women, of course, who out-earn men, of course. This is not a sweeping generalization, but typically we don't. So financially, emotionally, if you don't partner, what does your life look like? And so what I found is most people were meeting partners online. So most of them did, with varying degrees of success. And some had hideous experiences, as we've discussed. And some thought, forget it, I'm never doing that again. Some met their partners in a more organic way, joining meetups, joining groups, something like that, a cycling group, whatever. But overall, the message that I got is the women were just amazing anyway. And so they had all decided, I'm open to a partner, I want a partner, but I will also, in the meantime, should this not happen, because there's no guarantees, you can't say you do these things and you will find a partner. You may not.
Yeah.
So what we came up with, or what came out of the research, was you make your life rich no matter what your life is. So you choose your adventures. You go teach in Morocco and the DR. You make an adventurous life and a rich life whether you find a partner or not. And then in that process, you very well may, and then, you know, see what happens there. But it was a great, it's a great thing to study, because we all want love, we all want connection, and we all want partners to do things with and to make us feel safe and just to have an ally. So I think everyone does, but sometimes if that partner doesn't come, then you have to find that in other ways. So I found women were looking at alternative living arrangements, almost communal living arrangements, where there are small houses and you have your own kitchen, but there's also a central kitchen. And so these are cropping up all over the country where people have found a community. And so it's different from the traditional single household where we don't really care for one another to that level.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of creative ways that people have found support and partnership, even if it's not the traditional partner, you know, you visualized. Yeah. So pretty neat. We're resilient, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. So what would you tell someone younger, maybe yourself at 20, that you know now?
I would say to stop being so afraid. I have a lot of fears around money. So that fear has stopped me from doing a lot of things. So when I look back, I think my thought was, because this is what my family does, we are workers, you work, that's just what you do. And so I wanted to go and be on Broadway because I sing, I love to sing. Mm-hmm. I wanted that so much, but there's no way I could even conceive of doing that. How would I live? How would I do that? So I would say find a way. What I know now is that it becomes harder when you get older, because then you get more tied into a place or a position or an income, you know, no matter what it is. It doesn't have to be a ton. Again, psychotherapist, we're not known for our vast earning capability. But I would say you find what you love and do it while you're young, but you also need to be able to survive doing it.
Yeah.
So I'm not go to New York with no money and end up living in a hovel and, you know, putting yourself in danger. I'm saying find a way to make that work while you're less encumbered, I guess, and don't let those fears overtake your life. I mean, don't be foolhardy, but don't let those fears overtake your life. I still struggle with it. I will still, you know, have such fears around money or the lack of it that it will still stop me from doing things. And I have to catch myself and go, it's okay to do this. I can do this now. And I have a tendency to overwork because of that. And I'm always trying to rein that in. So that's what I would say. Just find your joy, figure out a way to get there and survive while doing it, and worry about the bigger stuff later, and don't feel so burdened when you're 20. For crying out loud, you're generally young and healthy, and you have so many opportunities to restart. You know, you get older, it's more difficult, I think, but not always, but it's more difficult.
Right.
So that's what I'd say. Fairly disjointed advice, but.
No, great. Yeah. Absolutely great. Well, thank you so much. It's been so fun hanging out and inviting other people in to hear about this life you've had that has taken many different, it's actually been many lives. So very cool.
And thank you for doing this very interesting thing to look at. You know, women are amazing.
They are. I mean, it's amazing. I just started looking around at just the women I knew and thought, wow, when I think about their accomplishments and how they make the most of whatever comes their way, you know, it's a big inspiration to me. So hopefully people are reaching out to friends out there, and that's a great way to cope with what's going on right now. So,
absolutely.
All right. Thanks again. Don't run away with me.